Home canning is making a comeback. The Wall Street Journal wonders if it's the recession. Some people say it's the local food movement. Support your local growers, which requires a little canning. Other people miss the jams and treats they may remember from childhood. There are canning parties on the web now. Imagine steamy, fragrant kitchens stretching across the country. Our own Linda Wertheimer spent a morning learning the basics of home canning from a food blogger known as Mrs. Wheelbarrow.
Kathy Barrow cans because she loves good food.
I guess it was 4 or 5 years ago I started going to farmers markets 5 times a week. And I get enamored of the food. I can't help myself. And there are only 2 of us, but I come home with enough for 8. And so I had to learn to do something with it.
Why not bag it and freeze it? Surely that's easier.
I have an extra freezer and I have this freezer, but they're always packed.
So, canning. And Kathy Barrow's way is easy to learn. She started us off with something basic, crushed tomatoes, made from very ripe, very big beefsteak tomatoes, chosen for their musky tomato taste.
I want it to be honestly tomato-y. Heirloom tomatoes have that nice variety where some are really acidic and bright and lemony and others are sort of rich and chocolatey. But with crushed tomatoes, I just really want it to taste like a tomato.
Don't be intimidated when I tell you 20 pounds of tomatoes are piled up in the biggest bowl in Kathy Barrow's suburban Washington kitchen. She starts by dunking a few tomatoes at a time in boiling water for 30 seconds, then dropping them in a sink full of water and ice cubes. That makes them easier to peel.
I slice an X in the bottom to help loosen the skin, and then I take the core out. And then the skin should just peel right off.
In 4 great big pieces,
in
it looks like.
4 big pieces.
Then Kathy Barrow gets personal, gets physical with her tomatoes. She takes those big, slippery red globes in 2 hands and squeezes, losing the juice and the seeds in the sink, saving the pulp.
So there's very little moisture in here after I'm done squeezing.
Okay, we're looking at a big stock pot that's about half full of mashed up tomatoes, crushed tomatoes. Now, when you cook them, you're not really going to cook them very much.
No, I'm only going to cook them for 5 minutes, but it will take a little bit to get it up there. So while I squeeze the rest of the tomatoes, I'll get this started.
Once the tomatoes start really boiling, Kathy Barrow sets a 5-minute timer. Would you believe we're almost done?
I want to dispel the notion that it's hard and takes a lot of time to can.
Maybe not time, but it does take stuff. Fortunately, most of it's from the hardware store and not very expensive. You can buy a case of jars, which come with lids that seal, little flat discs with a red ring on the bottom, and rings, the screw-down part. Kathy Barrow boils the lids and rings in a saucepan to sterilize them and then fishes them out of the hot water.
My favorite tool of all is the magnetic lifter. It was 99 cents, and it stopped me from burning my fingers, so that was a good move.
To sterilize the jars, she runs them through the dishwasher. She says that does the trick. Barrow fills those clean jars with hot, crushed tomatoes, leaving 1/2 inch headroom. She puts the lids in place, then screws on the rings.
And I'm just finger-tightening the rings, not super tight.
The jars go into an even larger pot submerged in a boiling water bath. They come out 45 minutes later.
There, look at it. Isn't that beautiful? Wouldn't you like to pull that out in January?
For spaghetti sauce or salsa? Kathy Barrow teaches canning. She blogs about it as Mrs. Wheelbarrow. She collects cookbooks and recipes and lots of equipment, but she says, you can make green tomato refrigerator pickles with no equipment, just jars. She ordered bright green cherry tomatoes from a local farmer, and he brought her 12 pounds.
I said, John, I don't need all of these. He said, I can't sell them. You're going to have to take them. So I'm pickling green cherry tomatoes for the masses. I don't know. I don't know who's going to get them all, but if you're on my Christmas list, you'll be getting these.
She put equal parts vinegar and water on to boil, put a few tablespoons of salt and sugar into each jar, pricked each hard little tomato with a knife, and stuffed them into jars with some extra flavoring.
That was yellow mustard seed, and now I'm going to add some coriander seed, and then some black peppercorn.
What is that?
That's a bay leaf. It's going into each one. It's a very basic pickling mix.
Also into the jar, a little red chili pepper and a peeled clove of garlic.
I want it to be whole because it's so pretty when it floats like that. I think a lot about what the jars look like when they're done. It's not just what's in them, how good it tastes, but I want them to be really pretty, too.
Kathy Barrow pours the boiling brine into the jars of tomatoes. They cool on the counter, then sit in the refrigerator for a week, and they're done. The cherry tomatoes turn from little green golf balls into crunchy, spicy snacks. Learn this recipe, she says, and you can pickle green beans or cauliflower or jalapenos.
I don't think anything could be easier than making a pickle like this.
The most exotic thing we made was French-style fig jam with sliced lemons, spiced with thyme, sweetened with honey. It's Kathy's own invention.
A friend of mine who really hates figs, I mean hates them, said, "My stupid tree is full of fruit. Do you want any?" And I was, yes, and I ran out and picked 4 pounds and then stared at them for several hours while I looked to figure out what to make out of them.
She cuts the figs in half, slices the lemons very thin, sweetens it, and simmers the jam until it starts to thicken. It sits overnight to develop flavors, then she boils it up, packs it into jars that go into that boiling water bath. It's really good.
Do you have a fig tree?
No, actually. But the Truitts next door do.
Perfect. And they go out of town every August, right?
It took about 3 hours to produce jars of crushed tomatoes, refrigerator pickles, beautiful jam, and here's the sound that every home canner loves to hear. That little thunk tells you the lid is airtight, that a morning of hard work has ended with delicious food safely sealed.
The music of the jars. Yeah.
NPR's Linda Wertheimer with home canner Kathy Barrow. You can go to npr.org for links to Mrs. Wheelbarrow's Kitchen and the recipes. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. When Captain John Smith entered the Chesapeake Bay in the summer of 1608, he found oysters in abundance. He wrote in his journal, "They lay as thick as stones." By the 1800s, watermen were harvesting millions of bushels of oysters every year. Chesapeake oysters became a delicacy served in the country's finest restaurants. But the succulent shellfish have been loved almost to extinction. Overfishing, disease, and pollution have left the Chesapeake with only about 1% of the oysters it had back then. Now scientists and business people are making some headway in bringing them back for the sake of oyster lovers and the bay. We hear that story from NPR's Elizabeth Shogren.
Marine biologist David Schulte has been trying to engineer a recovery for the bay's oysters, starting with one of its small tributaries. We set anchor over one of the reefs he built on Virginia's Great Wicomico River, and he sends what looks like a lime green canister vacuum cleaner overboard. It's a remote-controlled submarine. Schulte's theory was, if you build it, and build it big enough, they will come. And for the past several years, baby oysters have been coming by the millions to his reefs.
Now that's a great shot right there.
He's peering at a screen at lots of craggy shells standing on end in the murky brown water.
Those oysters are all growing very vertically, very densely packed together. Really, this was the first time this was documented in the Chesapeake Bay in over a century.
1,000 oysters per square meter. That's what nature used to provide, but no one had been able to mimic it. Schulte says his restoration project is working where many others failed because he came up with a radically new recipe. After studying successful restoration projects in other parts of the world, he decided he had to build reefs much larger than earlier efforts. Instead of 1 acre, his was 100 acres. And after reading historic accounts of what oyster reefs once looked like, he decided his reefs had to be higher. So he piled up enough shell to stick up 1 foot or more from the river bottom, instead of a few inches. He hoped that would prevent the oysters from being smothered by the muck, like in previous experiments.
And it turns out that from all the data that we've got, I was right.
Why would that be controversial?
It hadn't been done, and it's more expensive.
Schulte works for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and he got $3 million for his project. He says his experiments should be scaled up across the bay to restore the Chesapeake oyster. But lots of other scientists are skeptical. Professor Roger Mann of the Virginia Institute of Marine Science says it would be wildly expensive.
Once you get into trying to do restoration in very large rivers, the quantities of shell that are needed and the dollars that are involved in it get to be extraordinary. And before you start spending those amounts, you need to be absolutely sure that your recipe that you're using is right.
Mann is showing me a hatchery at his university where he and other scientists are breeding oysters. In one room, several huge vats are filled with vividly colored water, one lemon yellow, one pea green, and others different shades of brown.
What you see here is increasing concentrations of algae. This is the food factory for the oysters.
Oysters eat lots of algae. That's what makes them so valuable to the bay. Scientists estimate that there used to be so many oysters in the Chesapeake that they could filter the whole bay in several days. Now it takes the few oysters that are left about a year to do the same job. Mann believes the best way to bring back oysters is to promote a new industry on the Chesapeake, oyster farming. That way, businesses, not taxpayers, will be footing the bill to put millions of the filter feeders back in the bay.
There's a lot of very clever people who are in this industry who are willing to work hard to build their oyster farms, and in doing so, I think, can have really positive ecological effects.
People like Ryan Croxton. Croxton is counting oysters he just pulled from cages in Virginia's Rappahannock River. Croxton started oyster farming with his cousin several years ago. His grandfather used to supply oysters to Campbell Soup. But no one had harvested for many years, and the family was about to lose leases it had to work the river.
We wanted to keep the lease alive. It had been in our family since the 1890s. And that's when we realized that there was kind of a disconnect in the way we were doing it and the way we ought to be doing it.
His grandfather's teams dragged big dredges across the bottom of the river, ripping up the habitat as they went. The Croxtons now grow oysters in cages. They started the farm so they could have a private stash, but they loved the product so much that they decided to aim big.
So we got a Zagat guide, and we looked at the number one restaurant in New York City, which was La Bernardin, and just called the reservation line. I mean, it's easy to be bold when you got nothing to lose. And we're able to get an audience with the chef and showed him the oyster. He absolutely loved it.
Now they sell 30,000 to 40,000 oysters a week for the half-shell market.
And what about the practices that your grandfather used? What do you think about them now?
that's my blood, so I got to be careful. But I do feel bad about the techniques that they used. We've completely abandoned all of them.
Croxton says instead of tearing down the bay like his predecessors, his operation is helping revive it. He takes me out to see his farm, a line of cages in the Rappahannock's choppy water. Croxton says there's no question that the hundreds of thousands of oysters below us are helping remove pollution.
I mean, each one of these oysters is filtering like 50 to 60 gallons of water a day.
So I'll hop in and pull up a clump of these oysters.
Tommy Leggett agrees that operations like Croxton's do some good. Leggett's an oyster farmer, too. But he also heads up oyster restoration in Virginia for the environmental group Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And he's become a believer in big-scale restoration projects, thanks to a mini version he built on a tiny creek.
So here's one shell in my hand with three nice oysters on it. And this is all wild oysters from the creek.
Leggett says he hoped some wild baby oysters would settle on the mound of shells he dumped into the creek, but he's been thrilled by how many mature oysters have made this their home. He says large restoration projects would be less likely to fail because of threats like sediment and predators, and would be well worth the high price tag.
We're not going to restore the Chesapeake Bay without oysters, period. It's one of the most important cleaners of the bay that we have.
And Leggett says now is a good time to make big public investments in rescuing oysters. His group recently came out with a report documenting that fewer oysters are dying from two diseases that have long plagued them and suggesting that they may be developing some resistance. This is good news for oyster farmers and the bay. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content.
You can connect with NPR and your favorite member station, wherever you are. Get the NPR app for your mobile device. You can also lean back and enjoy NPR.org, optimized for the iPad. This is NPR.
This next story reminds us of an unusual case of heroism in World War II. It was heroism in the service of science. During the war, German troops surrounded the Russian city of Leningrad, as St. Petersburg was known. Hundreds of thousands died of disease and starvation during the siege. During this terrible time, a small group of Soviet scientists guarded a rare collection of potatoes and plant seeds. They feared that years of research would be lost. The scientists refused to consume their collection and were among those who starved to death. 70 years later, their research institute is again under threat, this time from real estate developers. Here's NPR's David Green.
The Vavilov Institute of Plant Industry is in the same building in downtown St. Petersburg where those scientists huddled during the war. But much of the institute's work takes place 45 minutes away in a garden that holds clues to different strands of fruit, how they can survive harsh climates, and which ones make people healthier.
Let's go. The curator of this collection, it's mine collection.
Leonid Burmistrov has been a scientist for the institute for 40 years. Out here in the village of Pavlovsk, hundreds of varieties of fruit and berries stretch across acres. Burmistrov studies everything.
Like the winter resistant, resistant to different kinds of the fungi diseases or bacterial diseases and so on. What is the quality? What is the taste? And so on.
Until this fall, when the Russian government plans to sell much of this land to developers. The gardens aren't what they used to be, and weeds have taken over in spots. But Burmistrov says these plants remain vital to science. The idea of ripping them from the ground?
No, of course. No. It's not possible to think about that possibility.
Through history, this institute has had a love-hate relationship with Russia's rulers. In 1940, Joseph Stalin imprisoned the institute's namesake, Nikolai Vavilov, because Stalin didn't agree with his genetic research, and Vavilov died in prison. In the Cold War, though, the Kremlin was committed to science like this as a way to outshine the U.S. Today, the man leading Pavlovsk, Fyodor Mikhovich, still calls himself a simple Soviet director. He's written to everyone, up to President Dmitry Medvedev, to try to save this place. Sounding nostalgic, he says communist leaders would have supported him.
This feels like deliberate destruction, a continuation of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when famous scientists were destroyed, along with the science of genetics. Today, they want to bury the legacy of the genetics founded by the great scientist Nikolai Vavilov. What will we, the Russian nation, have to be proud of if we ourselves destroy this?
A court ruled that the law is clear. A government property agency can sell off agricultural lands like this. It's not clear how much land will be auctioned, but much of the fruit collection appears threatened. Scientists here say it would take years to relocate the plants, and developers are in no mood to wait. They're poised to build houses for St. Petersburg commuters. Andrei Anisimov is deputy director general of the government's Federal Fund for Housing Construction Assistance. He's been on TV making the case.
These plots are not being used. The buildings are neglected and going to ruin. That's why the commission has every reason to make this decision.
Scientists from around the world have rallied to Pavlovsk's defense. There's a campaign urging people to send Twitter notes to President Medvedev. And on August 13th, a surprise. Medvedev, or the manager of his account, tweeted that the appeals had been noted and that the president had ordered an 11th-hour inquiry. But so far, though, no final word from the Kremlin. Scientists say there are few places in the world like Pavlovsk, and many of the strands of fruit they've carefully developed might never be recovered. What's more, says Peter Raven, director at the Missouri Botanical Garden, there's the symbolism of a collection scientists died to preserve.
In doing so, they provided a real model of drawing a line in the sand for biodiversity that's inspired everyone.
Only not around St. Petersburg, where people are more fired up about stopping the energy giant Gazprom from building a massive skyscraper amid the city's historic palaces. Many brush off the Pavlovsk situation as something typical in modern Russia, a spat over property that will just end up making somebody very rich. There's also a perception that Pavlovsk was lost long ago. 78-year-old Antonina Krekstina lives nearby.
Look at these gardens. They're neglected. They used to have everything here, fruit and vegetables. Now there's nothing. Soon they'll probably have to sell potatoes just to pay their workers.
Some of the gardens could be auctioned off as early as September 23rd. All the while, Leonid Burmistrov, the veteran scientist, goes about his business, as he's done for 40 years. There's a new strain of blue honeysuckle he's working on.
If they say us, boys, develop this crop, we're ready. Let's go to the flowers.
David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
If you're going to be watching the Emmy Awards ceremony tonight, you might want to think of a nice drink to go along with it.
Mad Men is probably up for a bunch of stuff, right? So let's go with the old-fashioned.
That's bartender Derek Brown.
Take a thin lemon peel, about 2 inches long, about a half of an inch wide with no pith on it. Drop it in the bottom of a rocks glass. Add about a quarter to a half ounce of simple syrup. Then add a couple dashes of the bitters of your choice. And then 2 ounces of rye whiskey. Add ice to it. Stir it until you get the dilution you want. And it's a simple drink. It's delicious. And it'll make you feel like Don Draper. So, on his good days.
Derek Brown was mixing drinks and doling out wisdom behind his bar this past week. The co-owner of The Passenger in Washington, D.C.'s Penn Quarter neighborhood doesn't shy away from the title bartender, but it doesn't really do him justice. Derek Brown is more like a professor of cocktails. He's won numerous awards, and this year was nominated for the James Beard Foundation Awards Outstanding Wine and Spirits Professional. Like any spot where folks gather after work to let off steam, The Passenger is boisterous. But walk toward the back, through a narrow lounge designed to look like a vintage railroad car. Open the door into the Columbia Room, and the mood changes. The Columbia Room only seats about 16 patrons. It's open several nights a week for cocktails by reservation. It's both a cocktail club and a laboratory. Twice a month, Derek Brown offers classes in cocktail making. The cocktail revival isn't new. In the 1990s, the martini reemerged, and the last decade produced cosmopolitans of many colors and flavors. But Derek Brown proselytizes for authentic libations.
It is really an American tradition, and I think that people are in the mood to explore American ideals in a different way, that sort of Coca-Cola and hamburgers are not the only thing that America has ever created. There's great culinary traditions here. The cocktail is one of our greatest exports.
The cocktail consists of liquor, water, sugar, and bitters. But before bitters became a critical ingredient in the cocktail,
you had hundreds of different varieties of bitters that were made as curatives. They're basically there to improve your health.
Traveling medicine men peddled them out of their carts. Newspapers ran ads for bitters promising strength and vitality. In this class, Derek Brown says they offered other medical marvels as well.
One of my favorite was from Pond's Bitters, which claims that it cures both diarrhea and constipation. Okay. So my question, obviously, and your question as well, is how does the bitter know which one to cure?
Bitters eventually were regulated and taxed as over-the-counter medications. Many of them were banned during Prohibition. So what are bitters? Derek Brown lists the central ingredients, a bittering agent and a solvent like alcohol, water, or glycerin. And a little bitters goes a long way.
Oh, my God. Oh, sorry. Oh, that's awful.
So basically, whenever you taste bitters, there's this kind of visceral reaction. It sends a signal directly to your brain that says, you know, these are going to kill you, or that these can be fun. Right? Like a lot of bitter substances, coffee, beer, are things that actually bring us great joy. But they're adversive flavors, so it takes a minute to sort of adjust to them. More than a minute. I mean, a lot of people never adjust to them. It's sometimes disappointing when people come into a bar and they want something very flavorless, like a vodka soda.
No vodka sodas tonight. Derek Brown's class is full of amateur mixologists. On the sleek bar in the Columbia Room, Brown has placed 2 cocktails in front of each student. The drink on the left is a light caramel color.
Smell it. You notice, first of all, that in the aroma, definitely get the sweet vermouth, sort of like some of the aromatics from that, which might involve some herbal character, some spice character. But you get a lot of wood, mostly from the rye whiskey.
It's a Manhattan, minus the bitters. On the right, glowing with a deep, dark, almost coffee-like color, is the real Manhattan, made with bitters.
So let's try it.
Oh.
I mean, the difference is like lightning to clear sky, right?
The students in this class are going to try to make their own bitters. We start with a little of the plain bitters base, the basic solution of special roots and herbs and alcohol. Then mix in the aromatic bitters solution, which has more spices in it. Now we can choose a flavoring agent, and there are several infusions: cacao, rose and cardamom, grapefruit, lemon, and winter spices. We pass the decanters around.
Ooh, chocolate. Really well.
Bittersweet chocolate. Oh, yeah. Ha, ha. I think it's like walking into the Christmas part of a department store. Up and down the bar, the students add a bit of this and a dash of that. After each addition, the mixture is tasted and sniffs.
But you already put the grapefruit in, right?
I know exactly.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Could I actually get the grapefruit? I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to do mostly chocolate, a little bit of grapefruit.
The smell in this room is intoxicating. Small glass jars bear the unique stamp of each of the amateur chemists, who seem to be having more fun than you'd expect in a classroom.
I try to teach people, this is not how you make my bitters. This is how you make bitters. And go forth and make bitters. Because it's fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm happy.
You're happy?
I'm a happy camper.
What was yours? Let's hear it.
Cacao. Uh-huh. Just cacao. But now I'm going to add some of the caramel, yeah, because it's dark. So just a little bit. Those are some darn good chocolate bitters, I just got to say. Want to have a taste?
I do, definitely. Wow, like dark fudge.
It's fudge.
Yeah.
It's dark chocolate. So I decide to call mine Fudge Bitters, but the jar will have to sit for a few weeks before the mixture is ready for consumption. Derek Brown ends the class with a round of Angostura Sours, a classic cocktail, made with 1.5 ounces of bitters. The students raise a glass for a toast by Brown.
The well-made cocktail is the most gracious of drinks. It pleases the senses. Taut nerves relax, taut muscles relax, tired eyes brighten, tongues loosen, friendships deepen, and the world becomes a better place in which to live. Cheers.
Cheers.
Wow. That's a drink.
And you can find the recipe for Angostura Sours at npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Cheers. I'm Leanne Hansen.